The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In this forum this year, what I've attempted to do here in the last several years is to speak on ecological topics that tend to be controversial on the ecological left, and to kind of take on some of the current debates that have been taking place. So I suppose it would be kind of reasonable to observe at this point that what I'm introducing, as Pridham has said, is the issue of individual responsibility in terms of the ecology of the planet, as against corporate or governmental responsibility. Some comrades might be surprised that it's controversial, but actually it is quite a controversial subject. If you search the literature today of Marxist ecologists or radical left ecologists, the position you will find, and I don't know if this is universal, but if anybody can find a book by a Marxist or radical left ecologist saying something different, I'd be very interested to see it, because almost universally what it says is what is said is that the responsibility is government, the responsibility is corporate. To suggest that there's an individual responsibility is either a diversion or a dangerous diversion or a moralist approach to the issue of ecology. And I think this is a big problem. We can all agree that the main responsibility lies at governmental level and at corporate level, because they set the framework for everything that is done. But then to take that to a position where the individual doesn't have a responsibility, then I think it is a big problem, because we've only one planet, we all live on it, and we have to do everything we can to defend it. And also, it's been quite a divisive thing in the ecology movement itself, or in the wider movement, particularly in the direct action movement, the climate camps and the protest movements and all that kind of thing, because there you find a completely different attitude. I mean, they don't deny the centrality of government. I mean, when the campaign to stop the expansion of Heathrow, for example, a few years ago, they were all lobbying the government. It was a government responsibility, a government decision that was needed. But those climate camps were, what you could call prefigurative. In other words, they ran those camps as they would want to see society run in the future, after capitalism, and in order to contain the ecological crisis. The only food was vegan food, for example, and there was a very big stress on leaving the camp, leaving the footprint of the camp as light as possible. In other words, no damage to anything on the campsite, no litter afterwards, everything cleaned up and everything else. Now, not everybody can go to that extent, and I'll come back later. But that is a big divide. I mean, I can remember going on those camps when, in the days when I ate meat myself, that it was quite difficult, because, you know, to go in there and want to have a hamburger, you know, you would be chased off. So it's been quite a big divide. But leaving that aside for a minute, the idea that that the decisions taken by individuals are in any way a minimal thing is a complete misconception. Most studies that try to assess, and it's a difficult calculation, they try to assess the proportion of CO2 emissions, for example, or the use of water, we could say, but CO2 emissions that are as a result of individual decisions, domestic decisions, transport decisions, food decisions, way of life decisions, are all over 50%. They're all over 50%. The latest figures I've seen from the United States, for example, is 59%, which flow directly from decisions made by individuals. So we simply can't ignore it. I mean, it's not that I'm not here arguing, you know, that everybody should become a vegan and that nobody should fly and things like that. But what I am arguing is be conscious about it and minimise it. Because that raises another issue, and that is, you know, how can you really be concerned for the future of the planet, of which we've now got maybe three decades, to reverse to avoid an irreversible crisis, and take no responsibility for your individual actions. And some of these are big. I mean, if you read, I could give a list of books, but I won't give a list of books, but if you read the literature of the radical left on this, you know, most of them more or less ridicule things like, you know, low energy light bulbs, for example. This is often ridiculed. Or they just say, use low energy light bulbs and that will save the world. It's regularly said. But actually, it's two power stations. In Britain, it's two power stations. Low energy light bulbs, it's two power stations. Just leaving warning lights on and all this kind of thing. Recycling. Now, we can all ridicule recycling because often it's done inefficiently and everything else. But really, it's absolutely crucial, really. The use of single-use plastic, for example, is now a huge problem in the globe. There will shortly be more plastic in the sea than fish. And 90% of seabirds now have plastic in their bodies one way or another. It's a massive problem. And it's breaking up into small bits and it's polluting the whole planet. And we can't just say it's thrown in there by governments or it's thrown in there by big corporations. A lot is thrown in there from cruise liners and all kinds of things. But also a lot is left on beaches and thrown and goes through the drainage systems from individual people throwing things away. And there's no way around the situation. So we have to. And then there is food. Food is gigantic. The food agriculture is the biggest single emission of CO2 gases than anything else, and it's the biggest single user of fresh water, which is rapidly running out. Half of the food produced gets thrown away before it's eaten. Now, some of that is unavoidable, but it's not all unavoidable. And you know, we have to be conscious about it and avoid that level of waste. Then there's the biggest issue of all, which dwarfs actually what you may do in your household or what you may do in your way of life, and that's the consumption of meat. Human consumption of meat. There is a remarkable figure. And I must say that first few times I see it, I didn't take it at face value, but I take it at face value now because I know that it's true. That the production and distribution of meat for human consumption produces more greenhouse gases than the entire global transport system, land, sea and air.
That's amazing.
Land, sea and air. It's killing the planet. Eating meat is killing the planet. Just in itself, eating meat is killing the planet. Now, again, I'm not saying that, you know, everybody should stop eating meat straight away, although that might actually be a good idea. But even if people who eat three times a day decided only to eat it once, twice, people that eat once a day decide to eat it twice a week, this would have massive this would have massive positive repercussions in terms of the ecology of the planet. I brought some figures. Water. Water's running out. The rivers are running dry. The aquifers are drying up, and the water from the mountains is receding and everything else. So it's a huge crisis. Water is unevenly distributed across the planet, so some places are okay. But nevertheless, there is a huge crisis of water. Now, if I could just find this. Yes, okay, there we are. The fresh water it takes to produce the following. A kilo of beef, 15,000 litres. A kilo of beef, 15,000 litres. Sheep meat, 10,500 litres. Pork, 4,325 litres. And chicken, a bit less. I mean, this is a crisis of absolutely huge proportions. And the sea levels are rising as a result of global warming. As the sea levels arise, we're depleting the aquifers, which are historical, over millions of years. They're running out faster than the water's going into them. At the same time, the rising sea level is polluting them with fresh water, with salt water, in most cases. It's an absolutely critical situation. So we can't hold a position that this is just all the governments. We can certainly say that the governments take the main responsibility, but there has to be an understanding that every single person on this planet, and this might be controversial, whether a millionaire or whether they're a person starving in the global south, everybody has an ecological footprint. They are vastly different footprints, but everybody has an ecological footprint. And everybody alongside campaigning to force governmental change and structural change and campaigning for the introduction of a renewable energy system and everything else, has to at the same time just think about it. Just think about it. How to consume a bit less. So that's the message that I wanted to bring here today and put forward in the discussion.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. You take less time, but you allotted. That's very rarely it happens. But that will give us more time to ask you questions. So, Gordon, it's your turn.
It's 15 minutes.
15 minutes, yes.
Thanks. I had a couple of slides. Excuse me, but they're not. They're not really necessary. Sorry. I want to take two things as a given. One is that capital is at the root of the disturbance of the metabolic interaction between ourselves and nature. Bellamy Foster, Jason Moore, lots of people you'll know about have written about it in different ways, but I think that assumption is one you can take for granted in terms of what I want to talk about. And what I do want to talk about is the organisational requirements of doing something about a transition to a better world. How do we tackle that? And I'll end up with a notion of a just transition, which is a deliberately stolen phrase from a PCS document produced recently by the Public and Civil Service Union, which has several demands for a just transition to a more ecological way of living. It's a fraught subject because climate change frightens a lot of people. It makes some people very cynical. And as Alan said, there's not nearly enough attention on the left to the personal interventions as well as the socio-political ones. And I very much go along with that. I want to say four things, I think, really. One is, in terms of strategic, what do we do about it? I call myself an eco-socialist. And I think it's very much about somehow bringing together the ecological struggle, the struggles that are going on, such as the anti-fracking struggle up in Preston Road in Lancashire, and other struggles like that, with left socialist or libertarian organising against the capitalist structures, which actually are the root cause of what's happening to our living situation. How do we do that? And it's rather a big ask, and it's very fragmented in many places. So all I'm trying to do in the time I have is draw together some threads of how we might go about that. I don't pretend to be any more, give any better answers than that. The first one of the four I will mention is the refusal strategy. Just saying no is actually a lot more than it's often written about in the press as people who are against change, against modernisation, against what technological revolutions can do. If you're living as a poor person in a house in an estate in Haringey, for instance, the threat of having your whole estate demolished and replaced in a whole number of years forward is a huge threat. Even if the promises that go with it, I would say the utopian promises of new houses, new jobs, and so on, are dangled in front of you. To say no to that is part of the refusal strategy. We can learn from indigenous movements, particularly in Latin America, where they have said no to the rape of the earth. They have introduced the rights of Mother Earth, as well as the rights of people, in Bolivia particularly, through Morales' government. On the Cochabamba Declaration, I think there's a lot we can learn from indigenous movements about the refusal strategy, where in the many cases lives are actually threatened. The boycott, diversity and sanction movement, which is often against particular regimes, for instance the Israeli regime at the moment, is a way of saying no, no fracking. Keep the fossil fuels in the ground is a refusal strategy, a refusal to extract the anti-fracking struggle. Land and housing rights struggles, in which I'm currently engaged, if anybody gets Private Eye, you'll see in this week's Private Eye there's a cartoon of a court case which happened 10 days ago in the High Court, where we took the council to court for threatening to transfer £2 billion worth of physical assets in the whole borough of Haringey to a new private vehicle with Lendlease, the multinational, which has got social, political, environmental, ecological and actual physical life repercussions if it goes ahead. Some old people I know will not survive that. They're so frail and they don't want to move from the last house they're living in. The struggles are connected in that way. And saying no to housing demolition and transfer out of the public sphere is as important to me as what the indigenous movement in Latin America are saying, saying no to the destruction of the natural environment. So the refusal strategy is a very powerful weapon, is what I'm saying. And it can be fought out in particular sites of struggle. So it's really all about contested space. It's a very physical, geographically located struggle in different parts of the world, and it's about bringing that together. The second point I want to make is protecting community and natural rights, I think, are interweaved. The capitalist crisis forces us backwards in many ways from things that were hard won, and alternative directions need to be pushed forward. So refusing to have your community destroyed, protecting your community and the natural rights, yes, but is that enough? No, we have to go beyond that, I think, as well, to place-based collective alternatives. And the partner state, as some people call it. There's a movement now called We Are Plan C, which if you Google it, you'll find out what they're all about. And other, how can you say, transformative notions which raise alternatives to power are often built on the Occupy movement, what they were doing, and that famously tends to be rather ephemeral. It doesn't leave organisational capacities behind, but people do go places, they do other things, just like those of us who struggled in the 70s and 80s in the shop stewards movement and so on went into other places. We didn't forget the lessons of our early struggles. I don't think the Occupy people do either. They're still around. They're just called different things. So, and these are often place-based struggles, I think, because that's what people relate to more than anything else. I think capturing the local state is important, but it doesn't do it alone any more than returning a Labour government, you know, gives you what you wanted in the first place. It's something about a combination of the struggle in the streets and the struggle within the institutions. In the 1970s and 80s, we called it In and Against the State. And I remember being part of that, the pamphleteers who produced that. And that was about being able to go inside institutions and not necessarily be compromised by them. Compromising in practice, but not compromising your principles. Yeah, there is a way of doing that. I was a social service, a chief officer, a social service director for most part of the 80s in Hackney, and we had some hard struggles there against Thatcher and her cuts. I did that for about 9 years before I thought, enough of this, because you can only do it so long, and I went to other pastures. But that was like being in the law courts 10 days ago, crowdfunding for a QC to fight one of the world's biggest multinationals and my borough council, which we're doing. We raised 35,000, and if we have to appeal, we'll raise another 35,000. It's about being in and against, it's about using the institutions and at the same time not being co-opted by the institutions. So municipalism, yes, getting the right people into power, yes, but not depending on that. So I think it's a phrase I'll steal from Hilary Wainwright, transformative power as an alternative to dominating power. Too long the left has talked about get into power, then we'll do what we have to do, top down. And it has seldom talked about grassroots power, holding that power to account. The Corbynist movement may hopefully be able to do something more than we've had in the past about that. Certainly it's worth fighting for. So, place-based alternatives, there are many of them. There's the People's Plan in Lambeth, there's something called Our Tottenham in Haringey, there's creating community land trusts, there's examples like the Isle of Egg community ownership in Scotland, where they generate electricity from three different natural sources and they export it. So it's a very small example, but it's one that could be built upon. And in some ways, what's happening in Scotland perhaps is ahead of what's happening in England in terms of community ownership of land and municipal generation of electricity. Again, Germany has many better examples than we have here, perhaps, of re-municipalising and decentralising the grid. And I think that links, as an ecological struggle, to re-municipalising and decentralising the organisational methods which we ourselves use. And that means also connecting with how trade unions operate particularly, and not dismissing trade unions because they're too bureaucratic, but the opposite of that, in fact, making sure that trade unions actually do genuinely take on board transformative methods of operating and struggling, which have the ownership of everybody who's involved in them. They are not dependent on the right kind of leaders. And to that end then, I wanted to mention, but I have it here, the document called Just Transition. Yeah, that's it. Which is Just Transitions in Energy Democracy, and it takes on from things like the 1 million Green Jobs campaign and the climate action trade unionists work in alternative forms of sustainable development. Okay, that itself is often a conflicted phrase, but at least it raises the issue of what sustainable development might be. And this is produced by the Public Services Union, and the TUC at its conference actually this autumn actually published an incredibly, for the TUC and the trade union movement, progressive change-oriented resolution in relation to climate change. It probably hasn't been nearly well publicised enough. I've got some copies of them here if anybody wants. So that's what you can do by being inside institutions, but not being bought off by them, because these resolutions were passed through by the work of eco-socialists and leftists of different kinds. The demands of the just transition are things like worker involvement through the trade unions in building public services, statutory rights for workplace reps, energy democracy based on public ownership and democratic control of energy, localisation of the grid, national plan for transition to renewable energy, all energy including fossil fuels to be publicly owned for a transition to zero carbon, commission to look at regulatory frameworks, direct government intervention to create a national climate service, adequate resource system for tax collection, just and transformative transition to zero carbon economy, a civil service for people not capital. That's an example of people operating within their own institutions.
3 minutes.
To change things around. And that's been done by a major trade union in this country, which is trying to get other trade unions on board. And the big trouble is, Alan talked about personal change orientation and recycling not being taken seriously enough and linked to the political ownership change questions. I think parallel with that is needing to take trade union and organisational change issues, which are going on. I mentioned the TUC climate change resolution. Alongside what Friends of the Earth and a whole lot of other green people are doing, I'm still in the Green Party, just what people are doing and bringing them together in organisational form. And I think the decentralised ways of acting and looking at transformative power as opposed to dominant power and what that actually looks like is the way of doing it. And I think if, for instance, in Haringey, we can actually stop the biggest sell of local authority assets in UK history, and I think we will stop it, because we've got Labour Party, Green Party, some very good Lib Dems, Tenants and Residents Federation, the trade unions, all on site, despite what the Labour leadership actually wants to do, because they've been bought off by this huge corporation called Lendlease. And they are the people who are raping the earth. So I do think we have to link these struggles and create a methodology of solidarity in the institutions and on the streets and talk about the transformative P2P, some people call it, or Plan C, and various things you can Google about who these people are. But we need to bring these methods together. We need to bring these organisational capacities together rather than go down separate silos, which they often still do, and even within parties that seems to happen. Momentum, people in Labour don't easily talk to the bureaucratic machinery within Labour. They're finding that very difficult, even in my own borough, where at the moment they're trying to get rid of the leader and get their own people into power. But I think if you show organisational capacity and you link the ecological, the environmental, with the social, political, because they are inexorably linked by the fact that it's capital that is actually destroying our lives, then we need to bring these things together. So it's a plea for organisational rethinking and bringing the diversification together and making a lot more of fragmentation. And you can do it by linking the contests of space in space. So it's almost a geographical thing. In Haringey, we're linking with people in Lambeth, and we will link with people in other parts of the country. And of course, we'll have a media campaign as well. Issues around that, I think I haven't got any specific answer beyond that, but I think it's now is the time. The morbid systems of the old system were all around us, but the new is not yet born, and now is the time for us to organise it to be born. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gordon. That was such an excellent kind of complementarity on the role of individual and local community, absolutely vital to an eco-socialist way of thinking. Before Judith goes on, I just need to take half a minute. I will show you. Yeah. Okay. Judith is, as I mentioned earlier, she's a senior lecturer in geography at University of Brighton and a reviews editor of the journal Capitalism, Socialism and Nature. And she is talking another very interesting subject: what are the girls' age and gender in equal Marxism?
Yes, I was wondering whether, I mean, this is going to be quite different, and I hope it's not off topic, because I think we're really into some very, very interesting things for the last two talks. This kind of takes it back historically. What it's got in common with Alan's is that it's very much about a real controversy in ideas that might not seem controversial, but are very controversial in eco-socialist thought. So, the question is, where are the girls, which will become apparent at some point. So it's about questions in Marxist eco-feminism. And so I start off with the question, where are the Marxist eco-feminists? So Marxist eco-feminists have argued that Marx neglected women's unpaid work and that Marx neglected the question of reproduction. And this fits in with the new history of capitalism, which is connects to, say, world systems theory and the work of Jason W. Moore, which increasingly there's a trend to see primitive accumulation, the period of capitalist development, as driven mainly or even exclusively by appropriation as opposed to exploitation of wage labour. So instead of wage labour being at the forefront of everything in a worker's point of view, that's completely displaced by a view that capitalism is is intrinsically, naturally, if you like, a system of theft, in which the slavery, New World slavery, is indispensable to the rise of capitalism, and women's unpaid labour is also indispensable to the rise of capitalism. So people's money is simply taken rather than being extracted as surplus value. And this is regarded as essential to an intersectional kind of Marxism, as opposed to a literal reading of Marx or a Leninist reading, and especially regarded as essential to an eco-Marxism, or anything that puts different things together, hyphenated kinds of Marxism. So here's a quote, for example, from Silvia Federici, and this is now being relied on, say, by Jason W. Moore, who is incorporating Federici's analysis. So in her really interesting, controversial book, Caliban and the Witch, about the process of capitalist accumulation and the 16th century witch hunts as part of that, except for his remarks in the Communist Manifesto, Marx never acknowledged that procreation could become a terrain of exploitation and by the same token a terrain of resistance. He never imagined that women could refuse to reproduce or that such a refusal could become part of class struggle. Nor did he imagine that men and women might have different interests with respect to child-making, an activity which he treated as a gender-neutral, undifferentiated process. Okay, so already we think Marx saw child-making as a gender-neutral process. Okay, so this is what I would like to try and... this is a very succinct expression of where Marxism has apparently gone wrong, but I would like to question here. There are some more quotes here which I'll go through quickly from Federici. Here she's saying in a later paper that what she did was suggest that Marx described the condition of the industrial proletariat of his time as he saw it, and women's domestic labour was hardly part of it. Housework was below Marx's historic and political horizon, at least in the industrial working class. And there's another quote of the situation of the working class that he was writing about that was almost unable to reproduce itself, averaging a life expectancy of 20 years, dying in its youth of overwork. And that certainly is something that Marx wrote about. But what the interpretation of it might be quite different from Federici's conclusions. So I think within this work, a conception of patriarchy is at work here, that equates it with male domination. However, the power of fathers in patriarchy is supported also by the subjugation of children of both sexes. And this is within my title, Where Are the Girls, per se. There is also a limited conception of reproduction that reduces it to female biology. And only in that way could reproduction come close to failing when women actually work outside the home. The relations of production in mid-19th century capitalism were, however, still reproduced. If you have a Gramscian or within works Althusser or Bourdieu's book on reproduction, there's a wider concept of what reproduction is. It's not just about creating human beings, it's about recreating the relations of production. And indeed, in the 19th century, the workforce was being reproduced, the population growing steadily by both natural increase and net immigration in England. So that's where were the feminists? Where are the eco-feminists now? The question then is, going back to the time, and I'm looking at the 1840s when Marx first set out his critique of political economy, where were the girls, in fact? So here's the poem, the Broadside Ballad. Where are the girls? I'll tell you plain. The girls have gone to weave by steam. And if you'd find them, you must rise at dawn and trudge to the factory in the early morn. So that's what people sang at the time. And from a really great website that I found called strikingwomen.org, with lovely teaching materials for schools set up by some women academics in Britain involved in trade union work, women's work has not always been accurately recorded due to much of women's work being irregular, home-based or within a family-run business. Women's work was often not included within statistics on wage work and official records, which alters our perspective on the work women undertook. Women's wages were thought secondary earnings and less important to men's wages. And this is in the case of the census returns as well. We have evidence from a variety of sources that from the 1850s onwards, women engaged in a wide variety of wage work in the UK, of waged work. So the idea that women's work, that women do reproduction, which is unpaid and entirely within the home, and that men are the exploited waged workers, and that that's what Marxism is based upon, is not compatible with what's coming out now about 19th century history and what women actually do. Federici, who I'm quoting from at the beginning, was of course involved in the wages for housework movement. And I think possibly was quite influenced by her own experiences in 20th century Italy. She certainly wrote about that very eloquently. So a girl is the default textile worker. Here's an introduction to weaving from 1844. This machine is extremely light. A machine containing 20 drums may be attended by two girls of 12 years of age and is capable of 3,000 hanks per day for a working day of 12 and a quarter hours. And there are several such other references in the book to... you know how people say if they want to measure an area, they say it's the size of Wales. If you want to say how much work goes into something, you say how much a girl could do. And this is the author of that, does a nice poem about weaving that he's written to illustrate his book, which is for the benefit of manufacturers. You know, you're a pretty girl indeed, half the factory girl is ringing. The working lives of girls, women, boys and men were all entangled within their family relationships and close-knit communities. I've got a couple of examples. I don't think I've got much time, but these are a couple of my partner's great-grandmothers. Mary Ann Thompson, she can be found in the censuses. In 1841, she's in her very early 20s, a laundress, and she's boarding with a couple. The husband is a car man, and she is a laundress, the woman who she's boarding with, and she's boarding with their five children. So you have women here with occupations in the census who are working for money. And she was probably married in 1846. She can be picked up in 1851. In 1861, she is an ironer. Her husband is a dock labourer, and they have three children. In 1871, she is a laundress. He is a gardener. They live in Palace Road, which is described in the Victoria County History, using a source at the time, as very poor. Their eldest son was not in the household, but the further son is born. And then in 1881, when she's getting on a bit, she's still a laundress. This is before her death. And he's a gardener. Their youngest son is living with him. He's a gardener out of employment. So women do have described occupations, and they work at that for, in this case, for her entire life. That's not a picture of her. It's a picture of a striking woman. And his other part of the family, my partner, comes from Yorkshire. So Mary Ann Tetley, she was born a bit later. When she was 12, her occupation was written down in the census, work at mill. Her son was born illegitimately. And then she was married to William Sharp. And he, when he was 13, he'd been a coal hurrier. And this is a picture of what coal hurriers did. They pushed the trucks so that a coal miner could do his work, and the children, the boys and the girls, pushed the trucks down the mine. And he'd been living with the miner's family, which was quite typical of that. And after they were married, they had four more children together. She doesn't have any more described occupations within the census. Her husband became a coal miner in successive censuses, a railway guard, and eventually a railway inspector. So that's quite spectacular social mobility, but it never pays off in the family. So William Edward Sharp Tetley, the first son, at 12, is in the census as a miner. He himself rises to coal dealer and coal agent, and then eventually into employing staff, and his sons start as a greengrocer, i.e. a barrow boy, and they don't manage to get out of really working class occupations, despite this mobility within the generations. But it's reproduced within each generation until my partner went to university as an unqualified student in the 1970s. So where were the feminists at the time to talk about all of this? Because if Marx gets it wrong, and he doesn't give us a feminist account, who does? Well, there were a few feminists around. But one of them was a bourgeois feminist, Harriet Martineau, who was a Unitarian who published an article on women's education. And her feminism is completely undoubted. She was a very brave feminist. She was an abolitionist. But she was also a forerunner of people like Jeremy Kyle, because her accounts were entirely victim-blaming of the working class. So she wrote Illustrations of Political Economy in 1832. And these are great stories. They're really well written. It's part of Victorian literature. And she has here an illustration of political economy. Each gives you a well-written story with rounded characters talking about strikes and their lives, their working lives, etc., their daily lives. And then it ends up with Malthusian, usually, points from political economy that it brings out. So here, this is very Malthusian. If, observe one of the masters, you brought only half the present quantity of labour to us, we must pay double for it. If you choose to bring up large families, who will in turn rear large families to the same occupation, it is a necessary consequence that wages will fall to the lowest point. And then the manufacturer says, when the worker says, but our wages are at the lowest point, he says, no, they're not. Do you know no Irish handloom weavers who make only 4 shillings a week? And this is related to the New Poor Law, which Martineau was a defender of. Here's a cartoon of the time with the workers saying, our heads shaved and no shirt allowed, because the New Poor Law put people into the workhouses. Talk of West Indies slaveys, indeed. West Indian slaves. Fine, they're expectable mechanics to us. Compared to us, the slaves are respectable, skilled tradespeople. So where were Marx and Engels? Got to do this very briefly. Engels wrote on the condition of the working class in England at very great length about the condition of working class families. Just one or two things. He says that the women are the proletariat and the men the bourgeoisie. He was a socialist feminist, had already said that, but she published posthumously. And quoting a letter from a working man, he describes how women not only were at work, they were the majority of the paid workforce because they got less money. So therefore, men were laid off and women were taken on. And here is Jack mending his wife's stockings. My poor missus is in the factory. She has to leave at 5:30 and works until 8 at night. Anything quoted by Engels. Engels says, this condition unsexes the man and takes from the woman all womanliness without being able to bestow upon the man true womanliness or the woman true manliness. So it unsexes them and it can't put it back together in the mid-19th century. Humanity, it debases humanity, and we must admit that the sexes have been placed in a false position from the beginning. This is Engels writing in 1845 and foreshadowing what he would write later on in his book about the origin of the family. If the reign of the wife over the husband, which he finds when women have got paid work and the men are all unemployed, is inevitably brought back by the factory system, is inhuman. The pristine rule, the earlier rule of the husband over the wife, must have been inhuman too. So I'm being kindly reminded. So, you know, where are the girls? The girls are out in paid employment, and the idea that women are only doing reproduction and men are only doing production is not able to be justified either what's said by Marx and Engels or in 19th century history.
Thank you, Judith. The next speaker and the last one is R.S. Mann, Raj Kambulman. I need to explain a little bit about him. He was originally an agricultural scientist, and then he started taking interest in economics and got in touch with me, and eventually he was accepted to do his PhD with me at Oxford Books. And originally we thought of combining his agricultural scientist expertise and my interest on global food security, but he's moved on from there, and he's reading Marx very seriously these days. He's reading Capital Volume 1, so he's kind of getting introduced to. This work combines his agricultural scientist background, his introduction into Marxism, though you will find less of concepts in this, but also his background in the Punjab rural areas where there is a capitalist development in agriculture and enormous environmental consequences. One of them is the depletion of water. So just to kind of explain the background, there'll be a lot of empirical work, but that's the background to his work. Yeah, thanks, Raj.
Thank you for the introduction. And so what I'll be talking about is that when any country embarks on the Green Revolution journey to fulfill its food needs, and during this process, if it ignores the long-term ecological and environmental aspects, what is the result of that Green Revolution journey? And this small state of Punjab in India, it's an excellent example to study the adverse effects of Green Revolution. So I'll talk about the objectives of the presentation, introduction, some statistics about the area production, and groundwater depletion, which is the major topic of the presentation, and then indiscriminate use of fertilizers and pesticides, which was promoted by Green Revolution, socio-economic crisis, and conclusion. So the objective is to discuss how the agriculture has developed in Punjab. I'll be talking about since 1966-67, from where the data is available, to discuss the increase in the area under the non-conventional crop, that is rice, and to discuss the drastic decline in area under all the other crops, and to discuss the impact of rice cultivation on groundwater table in Punjab. So Punjab is a very small state. It's on the border of Pakistan in northwest part of India. its total geographic area is just 1.53% of total area of India, and its contribution of wheat to the total Indian production is 17.39%, and it contributes 10% of the total rice produced in India. So when India got independence in 1947, during the 1950s and 1960s, India was deficient in food, and it was it depended upon the US for the food aid. And to get out of this food deficiency, it embarked on the journey of Green Revolution, and which was launched in the mid-1960s. And one of the major part of India where it was launched was Punjab, keeping in view that Punjab was blessed with water. And the name of Punjab comes from Panj, which means five, and Ab, which means rivers. So it was land of five rivers. That's why Green Revolution was so first of all launched in that part. And Green Revolution was mainly promoted by use of high-yielding varieties, external inputs, that is pesticides and fertilizers, and assured irrigation. And two other most important components were that the government gave an assured procurement of rice and wheat. Whatever the farmer produced, the government set up the Food Corporation of India, and they assured the farmer that we will procure all your produce, and at a minimum support price. So they gave a support price guarantee to the farmer as well. So what happened after this? So you can see there's a lot of data, but just try to concentrate on the data for rice. That is the second column. In 1966-67, there were only 285,000 hectares of rice, which increased to almost 2,800,000 hectares of rice in 2014-15. And if we see the other crops, all the other crops, which were about 2,300,000, they declined to 700,000. So, same coming to the percent share of area, rice was just 6.82% in 1966-67, which has increased to 40.76% in 2014-15. So the area under rice has increased immensely in this small part of India. And here you can see it has cannibalized all the other crops. They were 55% occupied 55% area in 66-67, and now they are just 9.87. Now similar is the case with production. Rice, which was just 3.8% of the total production in 1966-67, its share in 2014-15 is 32% in production. And all the other crops, you can see that they were 68% in the beginning, and they have declined to 23%. So if we see the yields of all the crops and wheat and rice, so you will find that the yield of bajra and maize, they were almost at par with the yield of rice and wheat. But still the farmers, they prefer to grow rice and wheat, and you will find very negligible bajra and barley. This is because the wheat and the rice, they are procured by the government at an assured minimum support price. Now, if we see the minimum support price of different crops, this is the table which I have prepared about the increase in the minimum support price for different crops for the respective periods. We can see that the minimum support price, the increase for all the other crops, you can see gram, arhar, rapeseed and mustard, sunflower, groundnut, the increase in their support price was much higher when compared to the minimum support price of rice and wheat. But still farmers prefer to grow rice and wheat because these all the other crops, they are not procured by the government. So even if they grow these, they have to either distress sell it or they'll just go useless. Now this is the contribution to the central pool of rice and wheat. So we can see the rice in 1881, Punjab contributed 45% of the rice to the central pool of India. and which has although decreased to 24%, but if we see in absolute numbers, it is 77 lakh tons, that is 7700,000 tons. And similarly for wheat, the contribution to central pool is 116,000 tons, and percentage is 41.5%. So it's the major food bowl of India, this small state. Now if we come to the irrigation, the groundwater depletion part, how it started. So in Punjab, almost the entire area, percentage of net irrigated area to net sown area, almost all the area is under irrigation. You can see 99% of the net sown area and 98.5% of the net sown area is under irrigation. So there is not a single patch of land which you will find without irrigation there. The growth in the number of tube wells. So in 1980-81, there were just 600,000 tube wells, the number of which has increased to 1,400,000 tube wells now. And there is almost one tube well for every 3 hectares of land. So this is, here there were 5 tube wells for almost for per hectare. Here there are just 3 tube wells for every hectare of land. So this is the groundwater resource availability utilization. This data is from Central Groundwater Board. So I just want you to see here 3 figures. One is this net groundwater availability, which is 20.32 billion cubic meters, and annual groundwater draft, which is 34.88 billion cubic meter, and groundwater availability for future use, which is negative, minus 14.83 billion cubic meters. And the stage of groundwater development in Punjab, it's 172, which is the lowest in India. So I'll just read out the definition. The groundwater stage development of 100% indicates that the groundwater consumption is equal to the groundwater recharge. Groundwater development stage of above 100% indicates that the annual groundwater consumption is more than the annual groundwater recharge. And a very high figure for this of 172, it's a very scary index for Punjab, and it's the worst in the whole country, 172. So this is a study, small study which I and Dr. Preetam Singh we have done. Mm-hmm. So we just tried to create the ground of this irrigation requirement of rice and the supply of water. So in Punjab, 1 kilogram of rice needs 5,000 liters of water to be produced. And based on that, we found that the water requirement for rice for all these different years, we have taken average at 48 million acre foot of water is required to cultivate rice. And we estimated that the rain supply, the water supplied by rain is just 9.45 million acre feet. So the balance required is 38.56. Punjab now has roughly around 2.5 rivers left with it after the partition. 2.5 went to Pakistan. So we assumed that even if all the water is used for cultivating rice, which is practically is not the case, even if all the water available is used for cultivating rice, still 24 million acre feet of more water is required. Mm-hmm. So which is pumped out from the groundwater resources. So coming to the use of fertilizer and pesticides, so we can, here I have compared the use of fertilizers in Punjab and in India. So just you can see, if you can see this figure, Punjab uses 227 kilogram per hectare of fertilizer when compared to the Indian average, which is 128 kilograms per hectare. So fertilizer consumed as a percentage of the total in India. So we can, Punjab, a small state, it consumes 6.72% of the total fertilizer consumed in India. Although it has decreased, but still it is very high for the size of Punjab. The nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium ratio, it is described by scientists as the ideal ratio is 4:1. So if you apply 1 kilogram of potassium, you need to apply 2 kilogram of phosphorus and 4 kilogram of nitrogen. So it's not just that Punjab is using high amount of fertilizer, it's also imbalanced use of fertilizer. You see 36, 8 and 1, so nitrogen is being used very indiscriminately. Well, for India it's much more, a little much better than this, like 6.6921, much closer to this. So even in the terms of fertilizer consumption in kilogram per hectare, if we see Punjab for nitrogen 179, Indian average is 84, 43, 30, only phosphorus, potassium is less, 4 and 12. So even in this case, the nitrogen and phosphorus, it's indiscriminately high for Punjab. If we come to pesticides, we see like for the year 2015-16, 10% of the pesticide consumed in India was consumed in Punjab. Now coming to the socio-economic conditions of the farmers, on an average there are 3 farmer suicides taking place in Punjab every day. So there is a study by Singh et al. So where they have conducted a survey of different number of farmers. So where they have come up that on an average, like the, all the per indebted household for marginal farmers, there is a debt of 2,76,000. Small farmers is 5,57,000. Semi-medium farmers 6,84,000. So this indicates that percentage of these, like more than 80% of the farmers in Punjab, they are under debt at this time. And if you see the debt per owned acre and per operated acre, so if we see the all sampled farmers, so there is 71,203, and for debt per owned acre is 1,16,801. So the condition of the farmers, what this table tells, it's very pitiful. Coming to the conclusions, the monocropping of rice, wheat has led the farmers and the state of Punjab to a socio-economic and ecological crisis. If rice has to be grown on the same quantum of land, then the solution to the groundwater problem is to provide sufficient fresh water. So we wrote an article with Professor Singh and myself, why the central government does not want Punjab to diversify away from rice, and which got a very critical response. So even
it had 1,500 shares.
So it seems the Indian government, they do not want Punjab to diversify. So in that case, they should give the more river water to Punjab. And in case, if no additional river water can be provided, then diversification away from rice is the only way out. And alternate crops should be procured at the minimum support price by the different procurement agencies. And there is very little trade taking place between India and Pakistan due to the constrained relations, so that must be opened, because Punjab is at a distance from the sea routes, so this measure has to be taken up to promote cultivation of alternate crops. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Raj, and you actually taken less time than you could have taken. Okay, so we have about 40 minutes for discussion. So what I suggest is that first we will take, each one of you might have several questions, but I think that you should prioritize in the first instance one question. And if there is a second round, then we can go back to the same person to ask a second question. So let's have questions, or even if you want to make a comment, a very brief comment, so that more people can participate. I see one there, two here, three and four, so that's just four of these. Yes, and if you could also introduce yourself, because it's being recorded for the purpose of...
My name is Sergey from Turkey. I would like to ask to Alan, I think we should diversify between traditional meat production and industrial meat production. Because traditional meat production is quite important for mixed agriculture, traditional agriculture, which means for the eco-agriculture perspective, you cannot make real traditional agriculture without animal production. So I think we have to somehow distinguish. And when you say meat consumption and criticize it, I assume you criticize industrial meat consumption. And traditional animal production is still quite important socially, economically, for developing countries, and ecologically as well.
Good, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Andrew Sekland from Norway. Also to Alan. I fully agree that most left literature is rather harsh on sort of the individual responsibility, but to be the devil's advocate, I think, as it often is sort of used, it's more, it becomes only an individual thing. So you save on it and you save on that, but it's not combined with any structural action. Mm-hmm. But because you could turn, well, as I get you, and maybe that's your point, that if you are more sort of in a Gandhi way, okay, you act politically, but your sort of lifestyle supports, you walk the talk in a sense. If you're, for example, in Oslo, to take an example, if you say we should bike more, okay, you should bike more yourself. So you have those not so nice winter days, and then try, so you take the medicine which you tell others. That's my first point. So I think one should, okay, individual responsibility, but the first responsibility should be to be sort of politically active, because sort of pure change of individual consumption will certainly not do it. And then secondly, I think you cannot avoid the question of price.
Because can we yes. Wait for your second question in the second instance? It's good to focus on the first one, which is a very good one. Yeah, there is, yeah.
Hi, I'm Sabrina Fernandez from the University of Brasilia in Brazil. I have a question for Alan, but perhaps Gordon could comment on it as well, if it connects well. I've been thinking, when you were talking about this idea of individual behavior change, like, do you think an idea of like coherence connected to a notion of praxis, so theoretical coherence in relation to our practice today, if that would help, and if Marxist humanism could help in that direction to push the eco-socialist perspective in the way that we need to start making these changes today, not in the sense of just prefigurative changes in local spaces, but in general, so that we can actually push for this more revolutionary transition in the sense of what Gordon was talking about in terms of just transition and a different praxis today.
Mm, fascinating question. There was one at the end, yes?
Hi, my name is Jamie, and I'm from the political ecology department at Lund University in Sweden. And my question was for Judith, and I really liked your presentation. I feel like you didn't really get to the point where you were able to elaborate on the ecological aspects. So I guess I just wanted to ask a little bit of clarification on that, and specifically on what you were talking about, the precedence of accumulation over exploitation of wage labor and the socialist feminist praxis, and how this could possibly relate to issues of ecological accumulation by dispossession, if you could draw some links there. That'd be really
Again, a great question. Yeah, maybe the last one on this. If you could also introduce, because other people might not know.
My name is Jamie Goff.
Yeah.
Jamie Goff. It was really a sort of a question or comment on Gordon Peters's talk. Really, the second part, where you started to talk about sort of local based action to address ecological issues in a progressive way. I think that was your thing. And I think they have to be a bit careful here, because I think there's an awful lot that cannot be achieved, cannot possibly be achieved, merely by local initiative. You mentioned, for example, the question of renewable energy, small-scale renewable energy initiatives, which have been quite big in Germany and Denmark, haven't really taken off here. Now, the thing about those is that in Germany and Denmark, they receive the enormous capital that's needed, because you need a hell of a lot of capital to put in a whole lot of solar panels or to build a windmill. I mean, these are big capital investments. Now, that cannot be funded from the local level, and certainly not working class people at the local level. It depends on, in that instance, the national state. It also depends on the national state having rules about input of this energy into the grid, because the grid is necessarily a large-scale structure. And the rules in Germany and Denmark are good ones, and the ones in Britain are bad ones, from that point of view. Okay, so what I'm saying is that we need to be very careful in looking at these local, small-scale eco-initiatives and their material nature, their economic nature, and the relation of that to larger scales, like the national scale, because I think there's an awful lot of very utopian, unrealistic discourse going around about those things at the moment.
Okay, I think we'll have... you want to respond, or should we take more questions? Maybe we should respond.
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can respond to the third question, so if anybody can.
That's okay.
I'm not sure about that. But
yeah.
On the others, yes. Traditional meat production. Traditional, we should aim for traditional meat production, there's no doubt about that. There is, however, a huge problem involved. There's not enough land available. There is simply not enough land available to produce. Well, if we need a big reduction in meat consumption, and with a big reduction in meat consumption, the meat that is used could then be done by traditional methods. But the situation with meat production, particularly beef at the present time, is that beef is produced by producing vast amounts of grain and feeding it to cattle. That's what it is. Corned beef, I didn't know until quite recently, till I read Farmageddon, I didn't realise where the expression corned beef comes from. I thought it was something to do with the way it was cooked. I mean, I've always been eating corned beef when I was a child and everything else. But it's not. It's not. It's cattle fed on corn, which was introduced in the early 1930s, which allowed a massive production of additional production of meat. And that can't be reduced. The other thing is grass fed. Corn fed and grass fed, that's the two options. And people argue you should go back to grass fed. And it is better, but it is a lot less efficient to produce. And it needs much less land to produce, and therefore it's hard to see how it is a real option. Because the other thing is, of course, corn-fed beef, it loses 40%. I think it's 40%. Somebody maybe correct me of its efficiency. In other words, if human beings ate the corn, instead of translating it into beef, it's three times more effective as a food in terms of calories, because it's a hugely inefficient transfer of calories from corn into beef. So that I think it would be possible to go to grass-fed beef, but not the kind of beef that is consumed at the present time. It's absolutely impossible. Anders. I think Anders' question reveals the problem. I think it reveals the problem because it is really the standard answer.
Exactly.
That if you're more, if you concern yourself with your own footprint and everything else, well, you forget to campaign and forget to be political. I didn't use any of them when I did did my introduction, but I brought some quotes from recent Marxist ecology books on this. And Martin Empson, for example, that generally a very good book on agriculture from a Marxist standpoint. He takes up Al Gore in Convenient Truth. He says, Al Gore says, it encourages to use energy-efficient light bulbs, increase the air pressure of our cars to reduce petrol consumption, and so on. Some would argue this is important. Quote, every little helps. Every little helps, they would say. But the problem is we are tricked into thinking that if we recycle our rubbish, then the world will be saved. In other words, it's a dangerous diversion.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is really fundamentally wrong at every level.
Absolutely.
I think the idea that people that have no consideration for their own footprint would become more politically active around it is a complete and absolute illusion. In fact, the more people recognise their own footprint, the more likely they're to be campaigning on the general problem and going into the politics of it.
Mm.
So you know that's the way around that I would see it. I didn't quite grasp the other question, so I'd have to pass on that one.
You might want to comment. There was a very good question on Marxist humanism. And on the question of meat consumption and linking up with eco-socialism. I don't know if you
have. Would you like me just clarify a little bit more?
Yeah.
Okay, it's just the notion that Marxist humanism, there's a lot of discussion around new human beings, becoming a new human being, so we need to start changing inside as well and not just outside, because Marx brings this discussion of, back then we used to say men, right? It's a problem. So like the new men that would have to arise of this so that we could actually become revolutionary, so not just structural. From the the whole controversy around humanism and structuralism and so on, but if we're talking about just this idea that we have to change ourselves as well, maybe that helps to push the radical left not to think just in terms of if it's not wholly collective, and if you're saying something about the individual, then you must be pushing towards the neoliberal way of responsible consumption, things like that. And so I was wondering if maybe a concept of like new human beings, people who are changed as well in terms of our values, could help to push in the direction of what you were talking earlier.
Actually, you've given such a brilliant reply to your own question.
I'm interested in one other thing,
yeah.
And also one more thing, because Gordon was speaking about praxis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with the debate, but I find it very interesting. Because the other side of meat production is the treatment of animals.
Yes.
And I think we should be concerned with that as well, in terms of how we see ourselves. I mean, it comes back to our connection with nature.
Mm.
You know, I think the real essence of eco-socialism comes with modern human beings, those of the coming out of Africa, you know, 180,000 years ago and so on. We've always had a destructive relationship with nature, to exploit nature and live at its expense. And I think the key thing really in eco-socialism is for modern human beings to live in harmony with nature, as part of nature, and not in conflict with it.
Mm.
Now, I've not been a vegetarian very long. I'll tell you, I have not. I'm writing a book, and I couldn't write. The more I looked, I just had to stop eating meat. I couldn't do anything else. But it wasn't. But what tipped me over on it was reading Upton Sinclair's description of the Chicago slaughterhouses.
Mm.
And I got to a page of that, and I said, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. And when he described how the pigs arrived, you know, I just couldn't do it anymore. So this is an important thing as well to consider treatment management.
Yeah, Gordon.
A quick one on your question on the personal and the political structure, are they connected? I have a friend who he's a very nice bloke, but he refuses to engage in the political world at all. He says he does no harm, you know, and that's pretty good. I do no harm. I said to him, where's your pension fund? invested. And he started thinking about that. That's one way of connecting them. It's only one way. Glasgow University, for instance, have got all of their staff's pension funds divested from fossil fuels. Now, so every person who works for Glasgow University, you know, has got a political and personal interest in divesting from fossil fuels because they've gone along with that. So there's just one way in which you can, I think, connect the personal footprint. You know, it's your pension fund which you're going to live with. You're lucky enough to have a pension. Increasingly, a lot of people now don't, who live in 0 hours, but if you do have, that's one way of... It's just a comment on a connectivity between the personal and the political. On behaviour change and practice, I mean, it is... I think being an eco-socialist is, and I use the Marxist term praxis, you know, it's the continually interrogating the theory through your practice and the practice through your theory for hopefully for mutual improvement, not one at the expense of the other, not people who know up there or people down here who dismiss what they talk about up there. That still goes on all over the left, that I see it all the time. I think one of the ways through is through the crisis we're living through, I would suggest, are such that capitalism and its neoliberal, and I think any other foreseeable formation, increasingly cannot deliver the goods, the consumption goods either, that it has promised to its increasing middle and as well as working classes. Certainly where I live now, where every 10th child in the borough in which I live is in temporary accommodation or homeless, every 10th child in Harrogate doesn't know where they're going to live next year. There are 1 million new people coming into poverty, according to Child Poverty Action Group in England, since last year, forward to next year. 1 million new children coming into poverty through policies of this government on the austerity which keeps capitalism going. That's a huge crisis. Common sense dictates. So that's partly my answer is, perhaps there's a new common sense in which Marxism and a way of looking at the world, using it in its widest sense, which is...
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.